is Steph is against Thurmer. Mr. Dvorak.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Dvorak. I'm representing Mr. Steffes in this court. Mr. Steffes appeared pro se in the district court. This is a 2254 by a state prisoner. The court granted a certificate of appealability on the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. The issues that were initially briefed changed dramatically with the filing of the state's response. First, it raised the issue of concurrent sentence doctrine. This court granted a motion to supplement the record. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that issue. I'm hoping that the court doesn't need to either.
Actually, I have a question for you that's not about that. I don't think you need to spend a lot of time on that. Looking at the opinion of the Court of Appeals in Wisconsin, which is in your appendix, and I'm particularly looking at the section that discusses the sexual assault conviction that we're really focusing on, that there was a problem when the instruction omitted that optional phrase. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals says at the end of paragraph 20, based on those standards, and it means the Strickland standards, we cannot conclude that Steffes has demonstrated that counsel's failure to object to this instruction was prejudicial to the outcome of this case. All right, well, the state here has conceded defective performance for Strickland purposes, but I'm having trouble seeing why this is not a finding from the last court in Wisconsin to have dealt with this, that there's also no prejudice. And if there is such a finding, I realize it's summary, but you know as well as I do that we don't require state courts to write long discourses. Why doesn't that put the prejudice finding also under the same deferential AEDPA standards?
I think it is primarily because they didn't spend any time on it. We don't know what it is. And because of the findings below, I mean, the findings below by Judge Franke were saying that there was a significant probability.
Prejudicial. Yeah, I remember that. But on the other hand, not only this court, but the Supreme Court has stated that, you know, maybe even the state court doesn't have to do anything but state its conclusion. We don't require a well-reasoned opinion. Maybe we should, but I mean, but the law is that we don't. And so I'm very concerned about the possibility of saying, well, even though the last word we have from the Wisconsin courts is that there's no prejudice, we know better that they really should have found prejudice. I mean, I can't quite pull that together in my head.
Well, if the court is considering that as the last finding of the court, then we're under sub 2D,
right. D2. Right, and we would have to find it unreasonable. We
have to find it unreasonable. And I think in reviewing that, I think you look at, well, what did they have to say about it? Well, they didn't have anything to say about it. They made a very conclusory statement.
So you think you're willing to take on that burden of unreasonableness in light of this record?
Well, if we accept what the court has just said, that a blanket, unexplained, unarticulated, simple statement, throwaway statement, if you will, of prejudice is enough to be a finding of the court, then we're stuck. And if we are stuck with a D2 analysis, then we're back to what is the standard here, and how do you apply? How does E1 fit into all of this? So we're back to the Allen question. But nonetheless, I think that part of that analysis of reasonableness is what's in the record, and what's in the record is what Judge Franke said.
Well, I guess then they're kind of moving over a little bit to the merits. I understand the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, anyway, to be thinking in light of this overall story. I mean, it's an incredibly harsh sentence for a young person, especially somebody with Mr. Steffes' background, and I don't have any problem understanding why you're here, because it is. And I guess he's up for parole soon in November?
November, correct.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I see the Wisconsin Court of Appeals perhaps looking at the record as a whole and thinking that no rational jury would have. I suppose it depends how they define the word or the phrase under the instruction of. You know, it certainly doesn't seem to be unwanted by Mr. Steffes what was happening in these events. He allowed
again,
it, you know, whatever.
Well, and when you look at the facts of these cases, and you look at Mr. Steffes' age, you look at how all of this developed and the facts, I think we need to be careful about the types of inferences that we draw, the expectations that we have about what might have happened here, because the facts show that it was, for example, it was A.W., the youngest one here, the 12-year-old, who brought M.F., the 13-year-old, to Mr. Steffes. And Mr. Steffes was not involved in this organization or in the prostitution aspect at all at that point.
That's the broader thing. But I thought that this particular part of the conviction that you're really zeroing in on was about this episode of group sex that...
Oh, it is. It is, Judge, but my comments are in response to the state's argument in its brief. And in its brief, it says that there are sufficient inferences in the record from which the court can conclude that Mr. Steffes, it was at his direction. And what the state relies on there is the fact that of the manipulation aspect of it that Mr. Steffes...
Seems to be Howard. I think...
Well, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly, and that's, I think, my point.
Mr. Steffes did allow this to happen. I mean, the idea that this was all A.W.'s idea, in the light of this record and the way that Steffes and Howard, at least for this period of time, were working together, that's a hard for us to say the state was unreasonable in finding that?
Well, first of all, Judge... according to A.W., Mr. Steffes was not involved in the prostitution aspect of this until after he realized that M.F. was making a bunch of money doing this. This incident occurred at the very first hotel where there were only two people involved in the prostitution, two customers, two Johns, if you will, one of whom didn't get paid anything, the first one. So to suggest, or I don't think that is factually supported, first of all. That's one thing. I agree with the court that wholeheartedly that it's Mr. Howard that is running the show here. He's the one that's doing all this stuff. He's the one that's instructing them about all these things. We have A.W. who broke up supposedly with Mr. Howard because he realized that Mr. Howard was having sex with M.F. that she didn't know about. And when you look at the description, the very brief description about what we're talking about, I don't know what happened. We don't know what happened. What she said is that A.W. was having sex with Howard at the same time that she's supposedly performing fellatio on Mr. Steffes while Mr. Steffes is kissing M.F. What happened? What are we talking about here? They're all in the bed at the same time. That's about all we know, I think. And maybe there was an effort. Maybe there wasn't. And is that enough to conclude that there's a reasonable possibility? And I would quote, Judge, your standard that you noted in Canaan or Canaan. I don't know how to pronounce the case. But, you know, the Strickland standard is, a reasonable probability. Or, as you had said, a strong showing, that the chance of acquittal is better than negligible. And I think, given the paucity of the record here, we don't know.
Just a minute, I'll advise you to do that now. So, thank you. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Wisconsin representing Warden Thurmer. One point that came up in the Mr. Dvorak's presentation was whether prejudice was decided under 2254 D2, and it was my impression that prejudice was almost always decided under 2254 D1. It's whether or not there's a reasonable, whether or not the state court unreasonably applied the prejudice standard of Strickland to the facts of the case. Now, in this case, D2 certainly would apply, at least after Allen versus Wood, to the deficient performance prong. Prior to Allen versus Wood, at least in Wisconsin, that was primarily viewed as a D1 or a determination of law also. And there is language in Strickland, I think, to support the proposition that if the state court can reasonably postulate a sound trial strategy, that there's no deficient performance. Now, Wood versus Allen takes that away.
Yeah, let me ask you, even if we are under one or the other part of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and even if we say, because we look at the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision, it says they don't think it was prejudicial, okay, we do still have the job of reviewing what went on in this case, and is this inside the boundaries, as we often put it, for reasonable people to view this effort? And I don't see how it can be within the boundaries unless the idea of instructing somebody to do something just means passively allowing. And because I'm having trouble getting much more than passively allowing out of the facts developed
here. I think that's where the Wisconsin law is, but it's difficult to reach that conclusion solely on that the instruction case, which says if the defendant requests this language, he's entitled to it. But as I pointed out in the brief,
instruction would require the jury to find that the sexual activity was either by the defendant or upon the defendant's instruction.
Right.
And so
completely
passive defendant, which is one possible way of looking at the facts here, you know, he's just lying there, whatever. The Wisconsin trial court thought that a jury might have acquitted given this instruction.
And that's certainly a possibility. There is case law in Wisconsin that says a defendant's passive allowing is sufficient. And I think we leave.
But don't you need some evidence of please do this or anything? I mean, just.
Well, not if the jury could infer it from all the other acts. In the first instance, and second of all,
why does the jury have? I mean, what is there in this scenario to make the jury think that this happened because Mr. Steffes somehow instructed or did something?
Well, we had Mr. Steffes, and I disagree
and
with
Mr. Howard could have said, "Do this," you know, and I believe anything of Mr. Howard. But
in that regard, I disagree with you because Mr. Steffes was the one who made the initial contact with A.W., and Mr. Steffes was the one who introduced A.W. to Howard.
But why does that tell us about this evening, you know, or whatever time of day it was? Why does it tell us about this incident?
But I think you have to look at,
because a woman marries a man, he can never rape her, and we all have repudiated that thought. She met him, you know, she got married to him, she put herself in the position, but we understand that still there can be something outside the scope of that.
I guess I'm not following that.
Because he introduced A.W. to the group and did some things, then he automatically must have instructed A.W. to perform fellatio on him, and I just don't see the link.
She's incapable of giving consent, and so when he actively engages in group sex with her, why isn't that consent? Why isn't that sufficient to be at his instruction? It seems to me, given the totality of this circumstance, that certainly these two guys were exercising influence over these two young girls, and they were from the beginning, it seems to me. And given that, it seems to me a passive act in the middle of this milieu is sufficient to show it was at his instruction.
So you think it would be a closer question if both of the girls were 15, the same age as Steffes?
Well, my experience, and this isn't in the record, my experience is that that age, in a single situation with the two participants, both 15, it probably wouldn't have been charged. Most prosecutors in Wisconsin look at a five-year age difference
which, of course, didn't exist with Mr. Steffes. Mm-hmm.
No, it didn't exist with Mr. Steffes. And even if they'd been the same age in the milieu of this entire system, it probably still would have been charged. But
in terms of a single act. Wasn't Mr. Howard prostituting Mr. Steffes?
I'm sorry, was
Mr. Howard... Didn't Mr. Howard initially, after Steffes lives with him for a bit, send him out as a male prostitute?
Howard was also, I guess I'm not following.
Well, Steffes says that after several months of living with Howard, Steffes agreed to have sex with a man that Howard knew in exchange for cash. I read that as Howard had Steffes perform as a male prostitute, and himself, since Steffes was a minor, was abusing Steffes in a way that I'm sure would have violated Wisconsin law.
Yes, and Howard was prosecuted. I don't know whether there was a count involving Steffes in that prosecution or not.
But it could have been.
It could have been, at least.
Theoretically, that violates Wisconsin law.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, I don't really think... I agree that with Mr. Dvorak that there is a split in the circuits concerning the E2 issue.
E1, D2, I think is what we're struggling
D2,
with.
D2, E1, yeah. And I don't really think there's any reason for this circuit to reexamine the law on that regard in this case at this point in time. I'm certain the Supreme Court, having granted cert on this question once and not reached it, that they will grant it again and eventually tell us how we're supposed to deal with that. And I certainly agree with Mr. Vorek that it's a very difficult question. But I don't see any reason to do it in this case, because as I see this, the E1 issue only comes up in the deficient performance prong. And that's because Wood has taken away declaring that deficient performance is at least in part an issue of fact, which would mean that I would have to demonstrate in the record at least a conscious decision. And in this record, there's no evidence of that because there was no post-conviction motion.
Right.
I guess just a brief comment about the concurrent sentence doctrine, which I realize you indicated you didn't want to spend a lot of time on. But it seems to me the way Mr. Dvorak addresses that, it turns into a jurisdictional question. And while it's clear that there's jurisdiction here, the Supreme Court didn't do away with the concurrent sentence doctrine entirely. So it seems to me there has to be some amount of custody, if you will, which is sufficient for jurisdiction, but from which a court could say, as in this case, this sentence really doesn't matter at all in his sentence structure.
But, you know, it might, though. I mean, apart from the $95 special assessment, and we've found the equivalent of that in federal court, it seems to me that the thinking of the Wisconsin parole authorities might be influenced by how many counts of conviction somebody's in on. And if one were set aside, it might influence that as well.
Well, first of all, as to the assessment, that I don't think qualifies as a future.
Well, he's in custody. He's in custody.
Well,
we all agree
with
that.
But fines aren't custody, so how can an assessment be custody? And besides that, it's already been assessed.
As though custody is the only thing about it. But once you've got jurisdiction, you can examine other aspects of
Well, that's true, but certainly
no one questions that poor old Mr. Dvorak's and Dvorak's client, Mr. Steffes, is in custody for a really long time.
Oh, yes, he is.
Yeah. So. Okay. Thank you. So, I didn't mean to put you in custody, Mr. Dvorak. you have a minute.
I think the Ray case, in terms of assessments, custody, and assessment counts under Ray, that issue is closed, I think. And if the court decides otherwise, I would ask the court to follow the Fifth and Eleventh Circuit, I believe. And if the state really thinks that it has no impact whatsoever, then this court should just be free to dismiss the case. And what have they got to lose if it really doesn't matter? And that's the approach that those two circuits have. I've cited it in my brief. In terms of E1, I don't necessarily agree. I think a finding of prejudice is a mixed kind of standard. There are an assessment of facts that go into the final legal conclusion about whether or not something is prejudicial. So as with deficient performance, I think both you're considering both of those statutes. Again, totality of the circumstances, what happened in that room on that day when this supposedly happened? Who talked to who? What led up to it? We don't know any of that stuff. And we're just guessing about what happened.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your efforts for your client. Thank you as well, Mr. Weinstein.